Good evening, everybody. Could I ask you all to please take your seats? We're about to begin. We've got a full house tonight, both in the moot court and in the breakout rooms. So bonsoir and good evening, everybody. I'm Rosalie Jukier, and in my capacity as co-chair with Véronique Bélanger of our Formation Continue series that we've entitled Think Ahead, Pensez d'Avance, I'd like to welcome you all here this evening. J'ai le grand plaisir de vous accueillir à la Faculté de droit de McGill ce soir pour notre troisième session de formation continue de l'année 2012-2013, où nous allons aborder le sujet de droit international privé. En particulier, où sommes-nous après la décision de la Cour suprême dans Club Resorts Limited contre Van Breda? Ce soir, nous avons trois professeurs de notre faculté avec beaucoup d'expertise dans ce domaine qui vont nous parler de cette décision. We will hear from professors Catherine Walsh, Geneviève Sommier, and Frédéric Bachand, who will each speak about three different aspects and consequences of this decision. And I should mention that all three have graciously prepared PowerPoints that they will use this evening, and we will be able to post those PowerPoints on our website in the coming days. Before we begin with the formal part of our program, I'd like to just make a few housekeeping announcements. Please turn off anything that rings or buzzes so that we can all give quiet attention to the presentations this evening. There will be one break this evening after the first two speakers, around 7:30 or 7:35, so a little bit more than halfway through. During the break, you may get some snacks from the table in the atrium manned by one of our student groups. As usual, the food is not for sale, but rather the students would appreciate donations for what you take. Tonight, all the proceeds will go to support the McGill International Journal of Sustainable Development Law and Policy. This is a student-run, peer-reviewed journal established by McGill Law students in 2004. It provides a forum to explore the nexus between law, development, and the environment. This is a great cause to support, as over its relatively short existence, the journal has managed to achieve a circulation of over 800 subscriptions, so please be generous in exchange for the food and drink that they have graciously provided for you tonight. As in the past, you will receive an email with your attestation of your attendance at tonight's Formation Continue. In order for that to happen, I hope that you have registered with one of the students in the atrium. If you have not done so, please don't get up and do so now. You may do so during the break. I should tell you that you should not expect your email with your attestation certificate as quickly as you've gotten it in the past. The Barreau has told us that we are only entitled to send these out this time as of February 18th. But don't worry, that's well in time before the deadline. You will get them by email, but it will be February 18th. So if you've been here before, then you know that a special feature of our series is to invite a distinguished member of our community to serve as président d'honneur. And it gives me the greatest of pleasure to introduce to you our président d'honneur for this evening, Maître Martin Budman. Martin obtained his BCL and LLB degrees from the Faculty of Law here at McGill. He then went on to do a doctorate in comparative law at l'Université de Paris II, which he obtained in 1980. He was called to the bar in 1981. From 1983 to 1995, Martin Budman was a full-time law professor in the Faculty of Law at McGill, where he also served as Associate Dean Academic from 1989 to 1991. He has taught and published in the fields of security on property, comparative law, sale, and law and economics. Martin has received prizes from the Fondation du Barreau du Québec and the American Society for Comparative Law for his publications. It was a very sad day indeed for students and colleagues here at McGill when Martin decided to change career paths and leave academia for full-time legal practice. As a result, since 1995, Martin has pursued a practice in litigation and transactional matters and is currently a partner in the litigation group of McCarthy Tetro in Montreal. Martin Budman has also served the legal and broader Montreal community. He was a member of the Research Ethics Committee of the Montreal Neurological Institute and the Subcommittee of the Barreau du Québec regarding the English version of the Civil Code of Quebec. He is currently president of the Research and Knowledge Management Section, Quebec branch of the Canadian Bar Association, and a member of the Committee on Obligations and Civil Liability of the Barreau du Québec. Now, Martin Boodman would be an excellent choice as président d'honneur for a whole host of reasons, but it is particularly fitting that he is our président d'honneur at tonight's Formation Continue, where we will be discussing the Van Breda case and issues of private international law and choice of forum, because he has recently published an article entitled Choice of Law and Manufacturer's Liability in Quebec in the 2012 Annual Review of Civil Litigation. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Martin Boodman.
Thank you, Rosalie, for that very exaggerated introduction. It's a pleasure to be back in the law faculty. I come here occasionally, not enough, I must say. I have spent a good deal of time on both sides of the podium in the moot court, both as a student and as a professor. And again, it's a great pleasure to be here. I think also that I should thank Rosalie and Véronique, as well as the law faculty, for making these continuing legal education series available to people. They're really high quality lectures. I've attended a number of them in the past, and available at what I think is an extraordinarily low cost. So I think this is a really wonderful program to get people back into the faculty if they've been here before, and also to get some very good legal education. Today, as Rosalie mentioned, our speakers are going to talk about the Van Breda decision, private international law, which, funnily enough, I never took the course here. I have regretted it and have somewhat become one of the people who does a lot of the analysis on private international law in practice. And it's quite surprising, or maybe it isn't surprising, that it comes up both in litigation and transaction work that I do. There is a lot of planning as to choice of law in major contracts. There's a lot of planning as to whether to contest the jurisdiction when somebody is sued, whether to invoke a choice of foreign law, because if the law is not proven, then it's assumed to be that of the forum. So private international law has become actually one of those hidden elements in the practice of law that is becoming more and more important and more prominent. So I think it's a very good choice of topic tonight. The Van Breda decision deals primarily with jurisdictional issues, but it will, as you'll hear, deal with both the constitutional elements of private international law as well as the private law, domestic law elements of private international law. It's an extremely complex area, complex judgment, which I'm sure will provoke a lot of discussion. It will also provoke discussion about comparative private international law, that is the regime in Quebec as well as the common law regimes for private international law and conflicts of laws. So the Van Breda decision will be the sort of jump-off point tonight for both Professor Walsh and Professor Saulmier, and Professor Bachan will talk about proving the foreign law when you've finally established the jurisdiction where you're suing. So without further ado, I'll let Rosalie and Véronique introduce our speakers, and thank you very much.
Just going to bring up Kathy's PowerPoint. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, I am now privileged to introduce one of my colleagues who will start us off on the discussion of the Van Breda decision, Professor Catherine Walsh. A graduate of Dalhousie University with a BA, Professor Walsh obtained her LLB from the University of New Brunswick and her BCL from Oxford University, England. She has been a member of the Law Society of New Brunswick since 1979 and taught law at UNB from 1982 until 2000, when we snatched her to come here to McGill, where she has been teaching since 2001. Professor Walsh teaches and writes principally in two areas, secure transactions and private international law. She has co-authored a book on personal property security law and has been very involved in the UN Commission on International Trade, or UNCITRAL, on the Assignment of Receivables Convention and the Legislative Guide on Secured Transactions. She has already, a few years ago, spoken at our Formation Continue series on secure transactions. Tonight, we get to see her other expertise in private international law. Please welcome Professor Catherine Walsh.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. The Van Breda case actually involved two cases. It was a consolidated appeal from the Ontario Court of Appeal. Both cases arose out of injuries suffered by Ontario tourists while vacationing in Cuba. The defendant was the operator of the resort at which they were injured and was incorporated in the Cayman Island. Defendant applied in both cases to the Ontario Court, to the Ontario courts for a ruling that they did not have jurisdiction over it, and failing that the Ontario courts should not exercise jurisdiction based on the doctrine of forum non conveniens. Instead, the Cuban courts should adjudicate the dispute. The case reached the Supreme Court of Canada, or both cases reached the Supreme Court of Canada, and the hope was that the Supreme Court would clarify finally the implications of its groundbreaking decision some 22 years earlier in Morguard Investments versus De Savoy, a milestone in Canadian private international law. I will confine my presentation to the implications of the case from in common law jurisdictions, Ontario being the common law jurisdiction out of which the case arose. As Martin alluded to, it's important for all of us to have a good comparative knowledge within Canada of the jurisdictional rules in all provinces and territories, since in any interjurisdictional dispute, one needs to compare the possibilities for jurisdiction in all of the connected provinces as well as internationally. My colleague, Professor Sommier, will then look at the implications, which are rather more direct, but potentially just as important from the point of view of the jurisdictional rules in the Civil Code of Quebec. Unhappily, before getting into the case itself, it's necessary to go through the context or the common law basis for jurisdiction, beginning with the historical perspective, going all the way back to, say, the 19th century. The only common law basis of jurisdiction that were recognized were either the physical presence of the defendant within the territory of the court at the time of service of process, or the defendant's consent, given either explicitly or by virtue of appearing and defending, to the jurisdiction of the court. And the result of that was that a defendant could avoid jurisdiction over matters that were completely localized within the common law jurisdiction simply by skipping over the border before action could be brought. In response, English and Canadian legislatures proceeded to expand their jurisdiction through adding additional heads of authority for which service outside of the jurisdiction could be made. So they used a procedural device, but it was a logical one, given that the basic rule of jurisdiction at common law rested on service. So they said, fine, we'll just add the permission to service against defendants who are outside our borders, where any of these connections are present. Through the years, the service ex juris rules and the heads of connections that were recognized for service ex juris were expanded, so much so that English and Canadian courts in the 20th century were compelled to recognize the doctrine of forum nonconvenience, under which if the case is only remotely connected to the forum and a court somewhere else is better situated to entertain it, then the court should defer to the jurisdiction of that other court. And that is where matters stood when Morguard was decided, as I say, 22 years ago, 2002. The case actually arose out of an application to the British Columbia courts to recognize an Alberta judgment. And the Canadian legislatures, like their English counterparts, until the European rules came into effect, had not expanded the basis upon which they were prepared to recognize the jurisdiction of another court. So they'd enacted service extras to expand their own jurisdiction, but when it came to recognizing another court's jurisdiction for the purposes of enforcing its judgments, they said either consent or presence, nothing else will give us recognition, or will entitle you to recognition. And Justice Lafore and Morguard said that that very rigid and restricted approach to respect for sister province judgments offended federalism, and that federalism required full faith and credit to be given to sister province judgments exercising appropriately restrained jurisdiction. So there was a caveat on the full faith and credit obligation. The court must have been exercising appropriately restrained jurisdiction. And what did that mean? Well, if the defendant was neither present nor had consented to the sister province court's jurisdiction, then there had to be a real and substantial connection for jurisdiction to be recognized. But if that was available, then the a judgment would be recognized. So the rules on jurisdiction that came out of Morguard came about rather indirectly through the recognition, or through rules on what was appropriately restrained jurisdiction for the purposes of enforcing other provinces' judgments. That having been said, the Morguard principles were recognized and, in fact, established as constitutional imperatives on both the jurisdiction and recognition side in the court's subsequent decision in Hunt. The effect of Morguard was to make that third basis of jurisdiction, service ex juris, no longer automatically a basis for jurisdiction, unless the connections listed in the service ex juris rules conformed to the idea of a real and substantial connection, then arguably jurisdiction was impermissible at the constitutional level. Some provinces, in response, enacted legislation that sought to enshrine the Morguard idea. The provinces that did this based themselves on a statute developed by the Uniform Law Conference of Canada, the Jurisdiction and Proceedings Transfer Act. And that's in effect in a number of provinces, including British Columbia, Saskatchewan, and Nova Scotia. Under the CJPTA approach, jurisdiction can be based on ordinary residence or consent, implicit or explicit, but absent either of those, the statute creates a list of presumptive factual connections, that is to say, presumptive in the sense that they are deemed to qualify as real and substantial connections. They're rebuttable. The defendant can say that on the facts. A reference to a tort occurring in the jurisdiction should not satisfy the real and substantial connection requirement, but nonetheless, you do have as a starting point these presumptive real and substantial connections. For example, rights related to a contract, rights related to tort claims. There are specific heads that authorize jurisdiction on this basis. The other provinces, however, did not enact a legislative response, and that left the courts with the task of grappling between the with the interaction between the servus exiguus rules and the real and substantial connection limitation on them. Well, fast forward to 2002 and a decision of the Ontario Court of Appeal, which attempted finally to put some certainty and clarity onto the meaning or the content of the real and substantial connection idea. The court set out an 8-factor test for jurisdiction, emphasized that no one factor was determinative, rather they all had to be weighed, and those factors included not just factual connections, but considerations, rather subjective and discretionary considerations, such as fairness to each party and comity. The test proved to be somewhat influential in some jurisdictions, but other courts rejected it, Newfoundland and Labrador, as well as the New Brunswick Court of Appeal. And the academic criticism was rather overwhelmingly negative. The test was criticized as uncertain, complicated, plaintiff biased, and as conflating the distinction between jurisdiction and the second level doctrine of forum non conveniens, which comes into play only if jurisdiction is first established. Perhaps the article that reflects that criticism most directly is one that was entitled Muscat, a Real and Substantial Mess. The Ontario Court of Appeal obviously was doing its reading, and some 7 years later said, okay, we'll try to simplify the test. And they replaced the 8-factor Muscat approach with a presumptive connection approach. And that was returning to the servus exiguus heads, which they said should presumptively be considered, subject to rebuttal, as constituting a sufficient real and substantial connection to Ontario to justify exercise adjudicating the dispute. And they accepted 2 of the heads of jurisdiction in the servus exiguus rules from that presumptive effect. And one was the situation where the only connection to Ontario was that damages had been suffered in the province, and the other was where the only jurisdiction over a party who had been brought in under a cross-claim was that he or it was a necessary and proper party to litigation involving a defendant over whom the court did have jurisdiction presumptively under the servus exiguus rules. However, the test was still not completely devoid of subjective considerations. For example, fairness was still had to be brought into play even when a presumptive jurisdictional connection was present and even without rebuttal. Van Breda went to the Supreme Court of Canada, and it went there along with the companion case that I mentioned earlier, Charon. Justice Lebel delivered the opinion of the court on behalf of a unanimous court. And in deciding how to integrate the real and substantial connection idea into Canadian law, he drew a distinction between the principle as a constitutional rule and as a conflict of law rules. As a constitutional principle, the real and substantial connection test limits the outer reaches of the jurisdiction of the courts. He also confirmed, and for the first time so explicitly, that the constitutional basis for that restriction lay in Section 92 of the Constitution in the territorial limits signified by the words "in the province" relating to property and civil rights. So that was the constitutional side of the test. As a conflict of law principle, however, it does not constitute the test itself. It simply sets the outer boundaries of it. Content of the jurisdictional rules should instead depend on the identification of specific, objective, presumptive, factual connections. So approach very much like the Court Jurisdiction and Proceeding Transfer Act in British Columbia, which, as I mentioned earlier, lists a number of different connections, such as a tort committed within the jurisdiction, that are presumed, in the absence of rebuttal evidence or rebuttal arguments, to be enough for jurisdiction. So, under this approach, if a defendant challenges jurisdiction, the plaintiff bears the burden of identifying an acceptable presumptive connecting factor. In the absence of success at that, the court does not have jurisdiction. In deciding what should constitute a sufficient presumptive connecting factor, unlike the Ontario Court of Appeal, the Supreme Court declined to use the heads of jurisdiction in the Service Ex Juris rules as the starting point, or as the list to be relied upon. And I suspect they did that because the Service Ex Juris rules do differ from among the different common law jurisdictions. And so to have simply used the Ontario connections and the Ontario Service Ex Juris rules would not have provided any guidance to a province that had different heads in their Service Ex Juris rules. So instead, he proceeded to craft what should be sufficient presumptive connections for tort claims, because he was dealing with a tort claim, and the following list emerged. First, the defendant is domiciled or resident in the province. Not applicable on the facts. This was a Cayman Islands corporation. Second, the defendant carries on business in the province. Third, the tort was committed in the province. Fourth, a contract connected with the tort dispute was made in the province. Remember, these are just tort connections, not contract connections. So he's not suggesting that the formation of a contract would necessarily be sufficient in a contract action, but in a tort action only. On the facts of Charon and Van Breda, Supreme Court concluded that jurisdiction was present in the case of Charon on the basis of a connected contract, in the case of Van Breda on the basis that the defendant carried on business in the province. I'll come back to, in the context of forum non conveniens, I'll go into how the court arrived at that conclusion based on the facts a little further, but to so that we understand the analytical framework for the jurisdictional level, I'll move on to that now. Court also provided guidance on how the court should go about developing or recognizing new presumptive connecting factors. So all they had done was to give us four tort claims without necessarily negating the possibility that new tort bases could subsequently be recognized. But they did not get into other areas of the law of obligations, for example, restitution or contract or so forth. All they gave to the courts then was a roadmap for what they should do when a plaintiff put forward the argument that a particular factor should be enough for jurisdiction. Factor one for tort claims, which, as you'll recall, is domicile or residence in the forum, should be enough for any action based on the law of obligations. That's a generalized connecting factor that is recognized in modern codifications of jurisdictional law everywhere, including, as we've seen, the CJPTA, which recognizes ordinary residence as a universal basis of jurisdiction where it pertains to the defendant. The court then while recognizing that the list of presumptive connecting factors could be expanded, urged caution on the part of the courts in recognizing new factors. It urged a cautious approach and advocated the following mode of analysis. The court should consider the similarity of the proposed factor with previously recognized factors. Should look at its treatment in its own case law and in statute, and this is interesting, and with its treatment in the jurisdictional approach taken by other legal systems with a shared commitment to order, fairness, and comity. Well, since we can assume that that includes all 10 provinces and territories, I think this advice means that the Ontario courts, for example, should be looking at the CJPTA as well as the Quebec jurisdictional rules in deciding what factors should qualify. Establishment of an existing or a new connecting factor that the court recognizes means that the court presumptively has jurisdiction, but the defendant can still bring forward factors to rebut the existence of jurisdiction in the particular circumstances of the case. And the test under the Van Breda approach is facts which demonstrate that the presumptive connecting factor does not point to any real relationship between the subject matter of the litigation and the forum, or points only to a weak relationship between them. When I was chatting with my colleagues this evening before, with Martin in particular, the event, Martin asked, well, has there been a case since Van Breda where the defendant was able to rebut the presumption? And I said, yes. I said, actually, quite interestingly, a recent case which involved a multi-jurisdictionally connected tort action, which had resulted in both physical damage and financial loss, and part of the tort claim was predicated on misrepresentations that have been communicated to the plaintiffs at various offices throughout the world, including a few that have been communicated to the plaintiffs in Ontario. And the plaintiffs argued, well, look, you know, a tort was committed in Ontario because the place of the tort in the context of misrepresentation is where the misrepresentation is acted on. And it was acted on in Ontario. And the court said, well, yes, that's likely true in the general circumstances. But here we're talking about a small number of misrepresentations acted on in Ontario, caused damage, a small aspect of the damage in Ontario. And yet we have all these other events and these other torts, if you like, occurring in various other parts of the world. It's too weak a connection. It would result in universal jurisdiction being exercised whenever, in misrepresentation cases, whenever some part of the misrepresentation happens to be delivered to the head office. And so we find in this case that the presumption has been rebutted, even if it were sufficient in the first instance. In addition to providing guidance on what are presumptive connecting factors in tort claims, the Supreme Court in Van Breda also emphasized that there are two types of connecting factors that are insufficient in the circumstances. The first is the plaintiff's presence in the forum, so never enough for a court to assume jurisdiction simply because the person bringing the action happens to be a resident or domiciliary of that jurisdiction. Otherwise, there would be no limits on jurisdiction, and that presumably would also be offensive under the constitutional limitation. The second is damages sustained in the forum. In at least one of the Van Breda appeals, damages had been arguably sustained in the forum insofar as a significant part of the pain and suffering and the ongoing injury in the Van Breda case had occurred in Ontario after the return home from vacation. In the other case, the plaintiff had moved to Alberta and then British Columbia, so the ongoing suffering did not occur in Ontario, but in one case it had. And the court said this is too weak a link in itself. It would mean that it's somebody injured anywhere in the world. Once they returned home, if they were still suffering personal injury, the court would have jurisdiction over them. So that's not sufficient. As I've mentioned earlier, they required an additional connection an independent connection, which they found to be a related contract in one case, and the fact that the defendant carried on business in Ontario in the other case, even though it was not resident or domicile there. This reference to the damage, this reference to the damage being insufficient, in some respects begs the question. The court did recognize that a tort committed in the forum is a sufficient connecting factor, and also recognized that for some torts, damage actually serves to localize the tort within the jurisdiction, and they gave the specific example of defamation. I should mention that Van Breda was, there were two companion cases released with Van Breda, both involved defamation actions, in which publication was found to have occurred in Ontario. Publication, as you know, is the source of the injury to the reputation, of the damage to the reputation of the plaintiff in a tort action. So they said in defamation actions, damage serves to localize the tort, and therefore the connecting factor of a tort being committed in the forum will be satisfied. There are other cases in which this occurs. I mentioned misrepresentation actions earlier. Products liability actions arguably also are localized in the place where damage is suffered. A previous jurisprudence of the court, which was mentioned in Van Breda, has concluded that a tort in a products liability case can be seen to be localized in the jurisdiction where the damage is suffered if the defendant could have reasonably foreseen that the damage would be suffered there. In any event, we can expect the meaning and content of this factor to be this a thorny issue in jurisdictional cases to come. What constitutes carrying on business in the province? What degree of connection between the formation of the contract, carrying on business, what degree of connection is needed? On this one, the court was emphasized that advertisement would not be sufficient. Some level of commercial activity related to the dispute was needed, so mere advertising is not enough. On the other hand, a physical presence is not enough. And in fact, in cases before it, the court found that the fact that the defendant had targeted the Ontario tourism market through distribution of its brochures with a partner within Ontario that had a physical office there was enough. And finally, what about formation of a contract in the province? One of the cases before it involved a contract with the spouse of the injured person who had gone to Cuba to offer tennis lessons in exchange for free accommodation along with his spouse, who was the person who was injured. The court found that that was a sufficient connection to Cuba, the fact that their presence there resulted from a contract that had been entered into through an Ontario party, an Ontario present party, that itself had a contractual relationship with the Cayman Islands defendant. So far as the decisions subsequent to Van Breda are concerned. There's a recent British Columbia Court of Appeal decision, which though decided under the CJBTA, is relevant here. And the case is very, very close to a recent decision of the Quebec Court of Appeal that my colleague will be referring to. It involved a class action for financial loss suffered as the alleged result of an international conspiracy to price fix on the part of De Beers Diamonds. Now, De Beers Diamonds had never sold diamonds directly into British Columbia, but the plaintiffs, representative plaintiff, argued that the loss, the financial loss, which consisted of paying too much for her diamonds in a contract of sale entered into in British Columbia, was sufficient to localize the tort in British Columbia, was a sufficient real and substantial connection, the tort here being conspiracy and price fixing. It was also taken at both at common law and under the Competition Act. So that's an example. And in the course of that judgment, the court also discussed the possibility that in products liability actions as well, damage would be enough to localize the tort and recognize this. Is a presumptive connection always needed? In Van Breda itself, Justice LaBelle said that in cases where a tort and contract claim were combined in the same action, it might be sufficient if there was a presumptive connection only for one of the claims in the interests of avoiding splitting causes of action arising out of the same facts. So this is the same true, where you seek to add a third party to a claim against a defendant over whom you have established a jurisdiction, or must you establish that there is a presumptive connection also exists with respect to the third party? Ontario jurisprudence on that is just starting to work itself out, and there are somewhat conflicting decisions on the matter. At the Ontario Court of Appeal level in Van Breda, Justice Sharp questioned whether being a necessary and proper party could be an independent source of jurisdiction. So we'll see where that goes. And form of necessity cases are another area where the test may be much weaker if required at all. Form of necessity cases being cases where jurisdiction is taken, which is otherwise not available, on the basis that the plaintiff can't reasonably be required to litigate the case anywhere else in the circumstances. Justice LaBelle in Van Breda mentioned form of necessity three times, merely to emphasize that he was not saying anything about that issue for the purposes of the present appeal. In Van Breda, Justice LaBelle also emphasized that the new approach didn't apply to the traditional common law grounds of defendants present in the jurisdiction or consent to submit to the court's jurisdiction. With consent, it's possible to reconcile that connection with the real and substantial connection requirement if one envisages the defendant's consent itself as providing the necessary connection, notwithstanding that both, even at the constitutional level, there's no other connection with the case. But the common law idea of presence has traditionally included mere transitional presence, so-called TAG jurisdiction. There's a famous U.S. case where the defendant was served in the airspace over a state, and that was considered sufficient to ground jurisdiction in the U.S. court. Now, that situation of mere transitional presence has not really come up in the Canadian cases, but one has to ask, would a presumptive jurisdiction be recognized on such a mere transitional presence? If it were, one presumes that the defendant might quite successfully rebut that presumption on the basis that it is too weak a connection in itself to justify the court adjudicating the case. The Van Breda case has also had an impact on the rules for recognizing the jurisdiction of foreign courts for the purposes of recognizing and enforcing their judgments. For the common law jurisdictions, same rules that apply to the court's own jurisdiction also apply to the recognition of foreign court jurisdiction, both interprovincially and internationally. The Beals case that is referred to in the slide, having established that that approach in the absence of legislation to the contrary also applies internationally. And so there have been cases since Van Breda in which the presumptive connecting factor approach that was endorsed in Van Breda was used to conclude that an Italian court had jurisdiction and its judgment should be recognized because the tort in question had been committed in Italy. Van Breda also addressed the doctrine of forum non conveniens, that is to say, the discretion to decline jurisdiction, even though a presumptive connecting factor has been established and it has not been rebutted. The impact here is far less radical. The court confirmed, or perhaps more accurately reaffirmed, general principles. First, forum non-convenience must be kept distinct from jurisdiction, doesn't apply at all unless jurisdiction is first established. Second, the onus is on the defendant to establish that the alternative forum on the facts of the case, Cuba, is clearly more appropriate and not simply comparable. The court examined the list of considerations that should go into this exercise, both as contained, for example, in the CJPTA and in the court's jurisprudence in the past, emphasized that that list was not exhaustive, and in any event, the considerations in each case required a case-specific contextual analysis. So pretty open-ended as far as the exercise of discretion is concerned. The perhaps only new point here is the court observing that one of the factors for forum non conveniens, would the plaintiff be deprived or the defendant be deprived of a juridical advantage, as the case may be a less important consideration, because we should assume, at least interprovincially and even internationally, that the juridical advantages of various jurisdictions are more or less on an equal level. Where there were differences, fairness would have to be brought into the account to work it out. Based on the actual application of forum non conveniens and the emphasis of the court on the other jurisdiction having to be clearly more appropriate, it does seem that the defendant will have an uphill battle once jurisdiction is established. When we consider the facts of both cases, the evidence relating to the accident, the location of the defendant, the location of the injury, all of these were Cuban. We had a rather indirect contractual connection in one case and a rather slender carrying on business, again indirect, in the other case, and yet Cuba was not found to be clearly more appropriate. Despite the court's emphasis on certainty, it may be that at the forum non conveniens case at stage, fairness is the overwhelming consideration, and fairness in the context of cases of this kind looks at such issues as the relative deep pockets of the defendant compared to the plaintiff. Concluding remarks. I do think that Van Breda has provided a more structured framework for courts and litigants than the Ontario jurisprudence that had gone before. But that, of course, is not perhaps saying very much. But it has at least removed the need to balance all these subjective and discretionary considerations against the existence of objective factual connections. That approach had resulted in Ontario in jurisdiction being taken over defendants who had no connection whatsoever to the province, other than the fact that they'd injured somebody somewhere else in the world and that person had returned home. So fairness in those cases to the plaintiff sometimes resulted in jurisdiction. And that is no longer possible. So that much is certain. I think the case is also helpful from the point of view of CJPTA jurisdictions, because the approach that's been advocated is close to the approach that the Uniform Law Conference already created by statute for provinces that have enacted that legislation. So while Justice LaBelle emphasized that the content of the jurisdictional rules from one province to the next doesn't have to be uniform, the mode of analysis that was taken means that the jurisprudence from the pure common law jurisdictions and those that have the CJPTA is likely to be influential and provide more uniformity. The rebuttable nature of the presumptive connections undoubtedly leaves considerable latitude for uncertainty. Because even if you succeeded in showing a presumptive connection, the defendant, you'll recall, can still raise the argument that in the particular circumstances, a sufficiently real and substantial connection hasn't been satisfied. That does create uncertainty. But I think it has its advantages insofar as the constitutional aspect of real and substantial connection is concerned. Justice LaBelle did not get into the precise meaning or application of the constitutional side of the test, but he did emphasize that it does set real outer limits on the exercise of jurisdiction. So allowing the presumption to be rebutted allows a court, in the type of case that I mentioned earlier, the defamation case, which had misrepresentation case, which had where only a small part of the tortious activity had occurred in Ontario. It does allow an Ontario court in a case like that, where there's only a very weak connection, to say that even though, yes, technically, it's been established that part of the tort, at least, did occur here. It's so weak, and there are so many connections, more important connections to other jurisdictions, that we hold the jurisdiction is not established. And so it allows the court to get out of the risk of overstepping the constitutional limits on the exercise of its jurisdiction in situations where, as using Justice LaBelle's words, the presumptive connection is a very weak one in the circumstances. Precisely 40 minutes. So even if I was, nothing I said made any sense, I at least respected the time limits.
Thank you, Kathy. So I'm sure many of you have questions that I'll ask you to make mental note of, as you'll have an opportunity after the break, actually, when we come back from the break, to ask questions of both Professor Walsh and Professor Sommier. So, il me fait grand plaisir maintenant de vous présenter notre prochaine conférencière, la professeure Geneviève Sommier. Geneviève Sommier est professeure agrégée à la Faculté de droit de McGill, où elle enseigne depuis 1996. Son enseignement et sa recherche porte sur le droit international privé, le règlement de litiges internationaux, le droit de la consommation et la responsabilité civile. Madame Saumier a reçu une subvention du Conseil de recherche en sciences humaines du Canada pour étudier la théorie et la pratique de la juridiction internationale dans le contexte judiciaire et arbitral. Elle publie également sur les recours collectifs transfrontaliers. Madame Saumier est diplômée de la faculté, où elle a obtenu un BCL et un LLB en 1991. Elle détient également un doctorat de l'Université de Cambridge et a été claire auprès de feu le juge Sopinka à la Cour suprême du Canada. De 2005 à 2008, elle a occupé le poste de vice-doyenne à l'enseignement à la faculté. Elle est présentement déléguée canadienne au groupe de travail sur la loi applicable aux contrats internationaux à la Conférence de droit international de l'AE. Je vous demande d'accueillir Mme Geneviève Saumier.
Pendant qu'on s'occupe de mettre mes diapositives, pour faire mes guides, je vais présenter en français, mais mes diapositives sont en anglais. Alors, j'espère que vous serez patient avec moi si parfois je cherche mes mots parce que je dois faire la traduction simultanée dans ma propre tête, chose qui peut parfois porter à confusion pour moi. Alors, contrairement à la professeure Walsh qui vous a présenté une approche ciblée sur l'affaire Van Breda, moi, je voudrais partir d'un peu plus large parce que l'idée, c'est un peu de vous donner une approche comparative. Et la seule façon de le faire avec le Code civil du Québec, c'est de regarder le titre 10 dans son ensemble. Alors, je vais faire un rapide survol du droit international privé dans le Code civil du Québec pour ensuite passer à l'effet de la décision Van Breda sur les dispositions pertinentes. Donc, rapidement, pour ceux d'entre vous, et je regarde autour de la salle, puis je sais qu'il y en a beaucoup d'entre vous, quelques-uns d'entre vous, qui étaient impliqués en droit avant 94. Alors, pour vous, c'est peut-être les articles 27 et 28 du Code civil du Bas-Canada qui étaient pertinents en matière de relations juridiques transfrontalières. En fait, probablement pas, parce que même si ces règles-là étaient dans le Code, elles n'étaient pas vraiment connues ou appliquées. Au contraire, en matière de relations transfrontalières, en matière juridictionnelle, c'était le code de procédure civile qui était appliqué par analogie, l'article 68, que vous connaissez sans doute bien parce qu'il existe encore, et lorsque vous êtes face à un litige de nature purement interne, c'est cette disposition-là qui vous dit devant quel tribunal à l'intérieur de la province vous devez vous présenter. Bon, si on va vers l'avant un peu, on arrive en 1994 avec le nouveau Code civil. Une des grandes innovations, la vraie réforme dans ma perspective, c'est le livre 10, un tout nouveau livre, une codification complète du droit international privé qui remplace les quelques articles qui existaient dans le Code civil du Bas-Canada. Il s'agit donc d'une codification complète de toutes les dimensions, toutes les questions qui sont soulevées par les relations juridiques transfrontalières. Bon, vous verrez, je vous ai mis ici les quatre titres des dispositions générales, mais ensuite, la question de la loi applicable à une relation transfrontalière, ensuite, les règles de compétence internationale des tribunaux, et finalement, l'effet des décisions étrangères. Souvent, mes étudiants me disent, mais qu'est-ce que ça fait des règles de compétence dans le Code civil du Québec? Vous savez qu'on est encore dans le... combien de décennies depuis le début de la réforme du Code de procédure civile? Mais les codificateurs pour le Code civil lui-même n'ont pas voulu attendre. Et donc, ils se sont dit, on a l'opportunité de codifier le droit international privé, on va tout inclure dans le livre 10. Et donc, on a cette anomalie, mais c'est très utile pour les praticiens de savoir qu'il s'agit de regarder dans un seul livre pour avoir les réponses à leurs questions. Alors, le titre 3, qui est le titre 3e, celui qui nous intéresse, prévoit les règles en matière de compétences internationales des tribunaux. Je dis tribunaux, bon, le Code dit autorité pour essayer d'inclure d'autres types d'autorités avec des compétences quasi-judiciaires ou quasi-judiciaires, mais moi, je vais dire tribunaux parce que c'est peut-être plus commun. Et ce titre-là prévoit les règles de compétences de manière exclusive. En d'autres mots, on ne fait plus référence à l'article 68 pour décider si les tribunaux du Québec, dans le sens large, ont compétence dans une affaire internationale. Et l'article 68 le dit précisément, il faut... regardez le titre 10 du Code civil du Québec, mais je vous dirais que ça a pris beaucoup de temps pour les juristes au Québec de s'habituer à laisser de côté l'article 68 du Code de procédure civile et utiliser les dispositions du titre 3e. Pour moi, c'est l'utilité de la formation continue, c'est de s'assurer que ces changements-là se fassent un peu plus rapidement. Alors, ne vous faites pas prendre. Puis je vous dis, là, jusqu'à 2010, des fois, on voit encore dans des décisions des références à l'article 68, malgré le fait qu'on est rendu presque à 20 ans. Donc, d'une part, on a le titre 3 qui prévoit les règles de compétence en matière juridictionnelle. Et il faut reconnaître que ce titre-là, il est aussi, lui, complet. Donc, toutes les questions de droit privé que vous retrouvez ailleurs dans le Code ont leur équivalent dans le titre 3 en matière juridictionnelle. Ça, c'est assez différent de ce qu'on retrouve dans les provinces de common law. Même la CJPTA, donc même l'approche statutaire, elle regroupe vraiment un cadre beaucoup plus limité, essentiellement des questions contractuelles, délictuelles, des actions réelles. Mais tout, par exemple, tout le droit de la famille ou toutes les questions de statut personnel ne sont pas incluses parce qu'elles sont souvent réglées dans des lois différentes. Alors que le Code civil, comme il touche à tous ces domaines-là, on comprend pourquoi le titre troisième sur la compétence doit aussi faire référence aux règles juridictionnelles qui s'y appliquent. Alors, je vous ai donné entre guillemets, c'est en fait le titre des différentes sous-parties du titre 3. Donc, on a tout ce qui touche les relations, les actions personnelles à caractère patrimonial, extra-patrimonial, familial, les actions réelles, les actions mixtes. Donc, tous ces sujets-là qui peuvent faire l'objet de pratiques différentes ou des pratiques dans les grands cabinets, tous ces éléments-là peuvent se retrouver. Le titre 3 prévoit des règles de compétence pour les tribunaux. Quels sont les principes généraux, les principes de base? Bien, quand on est rendu à 4, ça veut dire qu'il n'y en a pas vraiment un qui a priorité. Néanmoins, on verra, puis je vais m'attarder un peu plus loin au détail, 4 types de facteurs de rattachement ou de fondement pour la compétence internationale des tribunaux. Le premier, c'est les liens avec le défendeur. Et là, vous allez voir des analogies avec ce qu'a présenté ma collègue Catherine Walsh. Parce que, comme elle l'a dit, c'est les principes sous-jacents d'essayer de trouver un tribunal avec des liens étroits avec le litige se reflètent de façon similaire dans les différentes juridictions canadiennes et même à l'international. Alors, d'une part, on trouve des règles qui imposent de trouver compétence, de fonder la compétence du tribunal seulement quand il y a des liens avec le défendeur. D'autres règles prévoient au contraire des liens avec l'action elle-même ou les faits sous-jacents à l'action. Ensuite, on trouve des règles qui font référence au consentement des parties. Et finalement, je dis exceptionnellement, mais si vous les comptez, c'est peut-être égal en nombre, beaucoup de règles de compétences basées sur des liens avec le demandeur. Et je reviendrai sur, peut-être vous voyez immédiatement, un des obstacles imposés par l'affaire Van Breda. Finalement, une des grandes innovations du livre 10 du Code civil du Québec en termes de droit international privé, c'est l'adoption de la discrétion judiciaire, la doctrine du forum non conveniens, qui fait de la juridiction du Québec peut-être l'unique juridiction de droit civil qui a cette doctrine de common law. Mais bon, vous êtes des gens qui sachez que le droit civil, ça ne caractérise pas toute la culture juridique au Québec. En fait, en matière procédurale, on a beaucoup déjà d'éléments de common law. Donc, c'est pas aussi surprenant que ça peut paraître pour des étrangers, pour nous, de voir l'admission du Forum non-convenience. Et juste pour vous dire l'impact, puis je pense que des fois, ça vaut la peine de citer des chiffres, j'ai fait une petite recherche aujourd'hui. Combien de fois l'article 31-35 est la disposition sur le Forum non-convenience? Combien de fois on y fait référence dans, j'ai utilisé la base de données Azimut? 297 citations. Vous me direz, peut-être pas tant que ça. Mais si on regarde les autres règles de compétence dans le Code civil, c'est des nombres beaucoup plus petits. 31-34, 75 références. 31-39, 26. La seule qui arrive, je dirais, à la cheville, c'est la disposition du paragraphe 3 de l'article 31-48 avec 154 références. Donc, tout de suite, vous voyez que la doctrine du Forum non-convenience, elle a attiré l'attention à la fois des juristes et des juges, et il y a une jurisprudence abondante sur le forum non-convenience. Mais je reviendrai sur l'effet de ce que dit le juge Lebel, dans Van Breda sur la doctrine du forum non-convenience à la lumière de la jurisprudence québécoise. Donc, je vais regarder plus précisément les 4 exemples, les 4 principes de base que je viens de vous mentionner. Donc, d'une part, on a la compétence basée sur les liens avec le défendeur. Comme a dit la professeure Walsh, c'est un fondement qu'on retrouve dans la majorité des systèmes modernes de droit international privé. Dans le Code civil du Québec, c'est présenté comme la règle par défaut, si vous voulez. En d'autres mots, le tribunal québécois est toujours compétent sur la base du domicile du défendeur, quelle que soit la nature de l'action intentée, sauf s'il y a une règle plus précise qui vient déroger à ce fondement général-là. Donc, le domicile du défendeur, on pourrait voir ça comme étant la compétence, la première compétence. L'idée étant que le demandeur doit toujours trouver un endroit pour poursuivre un défendeur étranger et l'endroit qui est le plus prévisible, c'est l'endroit où est domicilié ce défendeur-là. Vous me direz, bon, quel est le domicile d'un défendeur? Mais là, heureusement, le Code civil nous donne une définition de la notion de domicile, pas dans le titre 10, puisque le domicile est une notion qui s'applique aussi à, dans d'autres parties du Code, mais à l'article 78, en fait c'est 75 à 83, vous avez la définition de la résidence et du domicile des personnes. Et la notion de domicile, c'est essentiellement une combinaison de la résidence actuelle, donc l'endroit où la personne habite normalement, plus une intention d'y demeurer. Le Code parle de l'intention d'y faire son principal établissement. Alors, on a besoin plus que juste une présence transitoire ou une présence temporaire. Pour la personne morale, toutefois, à la différence de la personne physique, une personne morale ne peut pas avoir de résidence, puisque probablement elle ne peut pas avoir d'intention. Bon, elle peut avoir toutes sortes de liberté d'expression, mais pas d'intention pour les fins de cet article-là. Et le Code prévoit à l'article 307 que le domicile de la personne morale est au lieu de son siège social. Donc, c'est une règle purement technique. La compagnie qui a son siège au Québec est domiciliée ici, peut être poursuivie ici sans aucune objection, mais si elle a son siège social en Ontario, bien, elle ne peut pas être poursuivie sur la base de cet article-là. Et il y en a beaucoup de compagnies qui sont très présentes au Québec, si vous prenez l'exemple de, j'aime toujours la Banque de Montréal, parce qu'elle a son siège social à Toronto, et donc elle n'est pas domiciliée au Québec pour les fins de l'article 31-34. Ça veut dire que si vous voulez poursuivre la Banque de Montréal, il faudra trouver un autre fondement pour la compétence du tribunal québécois, nonobstant le fait qu'on en retrouve à tous les coins de rue. Les liens avec le défendeur aussi peuvent être précisés par rapport à certains types d'actions. Alors, on a une espèce de combinaison du type d'action avec le défendeur. Et ce sont des dispositions qu'on aura l'occasion de regarder plus avant, surtout en matière de responsabilité civile. Mais ici, je vous signale simplement que l'article 31-48, aux deux premiers paragraphes, prévoit la compétence des tribunaux québécois par rapport à un défendeur personne physique, si la résidence de cette personne est au Québec, quand il s'agit d'une réclamation de nature contractuelle ou extra-contractuelle. En d'autres mots, pour certains types d'actions, on permet un facteur de rattachement moins exigeant, donc la résidence au lieu du domicile. Pour la personne morale, qui ne peut pas avoir de résidence, l'article 31-48 à son paragraphe 2 prévoit la compétence des tribunaux du Québec lorsque cette personne morale a un établissement, donc pas le siège social, mais un établissement, et des activités au Québec. C'est un petit peu comme le carrying on business qu'on voit mis de l'avant par la Cour suprême dans l'affaire Van Breda, sauf que la jurisprudence au Québec a interprété l'article 31-48 de manière un peu plus complexe que le carrying on business. Du côté des matières familiales, il y a beaucoup de situations où, lorsqu'une des personnes concernées par l'action réside au Québec, ce sera suffisant pour que le tribunal du Québec se déclare compétent. On passe donc des liens avec le défendeur aux liens avec l'action elle-même. Donc, on présume qu'il n'y a pas de lien avec le défendeur, puisque s'il y en a, on n'a pas besoin de se rabattre sur un autre fondement. Parce que tous ces fondements sont alternatifs. Il s'agit d'en trouver un qui fonctionne, et là, comme demandeur, vous avez réussi à établir la compétence du tribunal québécois. Alors, par exemple, en matière d'action réelle, si les biens qui sont l'objet de la poursuite sont situés au Québec, bien, le tribunal québécois est compétent. C'est assez simple. En matière contractuelle ou extra-contractuelle, là, on a une série de facteurs de rattachement possibles. Donc, la faute a été commise au Québec, le préjudice, bon, vous voyez la difficulté déjà terminologique entre dommage, préjudice, damage, injury, et malheureusement, le Code civil au titre 10 n'est pas constant dans son choix de ces différentes expressions. Le fait dommageable que la Cour suprême a interprété comme étant dans un contexte de responsabilité sans faute, le fait générateur du préjudice, et finalement le fait qu'une obligation d'un contrat devait être exécutée au Québec. Donc on a, puis c'est vraiment la disposition, celle-ci, qui a fait l'objet d'une jurisprudence importante, les liens les plus disons, utilisés par les demandeurs en matière de poursuites transfrontalières au Canada. Une autre base, un autre fondement de la compétence qui est important, c'est celle basée sur le consentement. Je passe vite pour en arriver à la question qui nous intéresse le plus, mais c'est important de, d'apprécier le changement, je dirais pas révolutionnaire, mais significatif apporté par le livre 10 du Code civil du Québec, qui a permis aux partis d'exclure la compétence des tribunaux du Québec en désignant une autre, un autre tribunal d'un autre pays. Avant 1994, c'était considéré comme étant contre l'ordre public. Alors, avec l'article 3148, le dernier paragraphe, les partis peuvent désigner un tribunal à l'extérieur de la province ou encore un tribunal arbitral, et si c'est fait de façon correcte, le tribunal au Québec ne sera pas compétent. L'envers de cette possibilité, c'est aussi pour les partis de désigner le tribunal québécois. Je vous dirais que dans la jurisprudence, je n'ai pas encore trouvé un exemple de cas où il n'y a aucun fondement pour la compétence du tribunal québécois, sauf le fait que les partis ont désigné les tribunaux du Québec. Toutes les causes, c'est des causes qui soulèvent des clauses qui désignent des tribunaux étrangers. Et là, au moins, la jurisprudence est maintenant constante depuis la décision de la Cour suprême dans l'affaire Grécon pour dire que c'est vraiment un principe qui est fondamental et qu'il n'y a pas vraiment de façon de s'en sortir, c'est-à-dire pour les parties d'éviter d'être liées par la clause qu'ils ont choisi d'incorporer dans leur contrat. Finalement, il y a la soumission. Donc, si comme défendeur, même vous auriez pu vous objecter à la compétence, mais vous entreprenez des procédures où vous répondez à la requête sur le fond, bien là, vous êtes déclaré avoir accepté la compétence du tribunal. Et même s'il n'y a pas de lien du tout, le tribunal n'aura pas de motif pour décliner d'exercer sa compétence ou pour refuser de l'exercer. Je passe maintenant rapidement au lien avec le demandeur, parce que comme l'a dit ma collègue, la Cour suprême du Canada semble vraiment mettre à l'écart le lien avec le seul demandeur comme étant suffisant pour rencontrer le critère du lien réel et substantiel dans l'élaboration d'une règle de conflit, mais aussi possiblement pour établir la validité constitutionnelle d'une règle de compétence. Dans le Code civil, dans le livre 10, on trouve en fait plusieurs exemples de situations où le lien avec le seul demandeur est suffisant pour établir la compétence du tribunal. Et c'est surtout en matière familiale. Alors, qu'on parle en matière de dissolution d'une union civile, de la filiation, de l'effet du mariage ou de l'union civile, ou les aliments, par exemple, dans tous ces cas, on dit tant qu'une des deux personnes concernées est résidente ou domiciliée au Québec, le tribunal est compétent. Donc, juste de vous rappeler de ça parce que je vais finir avec une conclusion qui nous ramène à ce point-là. Une autre règle particulière au Code civil du Québec qu'on ne retrouve pas dans les autres provinces, c'est une règle spéciale, article 3149, qui donne un accès privilégié aux consommateurs et aux employés qui sont résidents du Québec. Donc, eux ont droit toujours d'amener leur cause contractuelle devant les tribunaux du Québec, nonobstant l'absence d'un autre lien. Alors, il y a une décision où vous aviez un travailleur qui est un employé québécois qui travaillait pour une compagnie australienne en Australie et suite à la fin de son obligation est revenu au Québec et a entrepris une poursuite devant les tribunaux québécois. Et l'article 3149 donnait compétence aux tribunaux du Québec, nonobstant le fait que vraiment le contrat, la relation de travail était entièrement à l'étranger. Je pense que, bon, même si l'Australie, on peut y arriver facilement par avion, c'est assez loin. Quand on pense au niveau géographique, ça peut surprendre. Et on a une règle similaire en matière de contrat d'assurance. Et finalement, je passe rapidement sur d'autres fondements prévus au Code civil dans les règles générales. Et là, on a le forum de nécessité dont ma collègue a parlé à l'article 31-36, une règle sur les mesures conservatoires ou les mesures provisoires. Même si le tribunal n'est pas compétent sur le fond, peut néanmoins être compétent pour donner des ordonnances conservatoires ou provisoires. La compétence d'urgence pour protéger des personnes ou des biens. Même si le seul lien, c'est la présence de cette personne ou de ses biens, le tribunal peut être compétent. Et finalement, la fameuse compétence de l'article 31-39, qui est le « necessary party », dont on a déjà parlé, qui prévoit la compétence du tribunal québécois, nonobstant l'absence d'autres liens, sauf la compétence sur l'action principale. Alors, je vais passer par-dessus Forum Non-Convenience parce que je vous en ai déjà parlé. Quel est l'effet donc de Van Breda au Québec? Bon, d'une part, si on aborde ça de façon très technique, on va dire, ben, c'est une décision de common law qui nous parle des règles de compétence dans les provinces de common law. C'est peut-être intéressant, mais c'est pas, ça nous lie pas. Les tribunaux du Québec sont pas liés par ce que dit la Cour suprême dans son élaboration de règles pour les provinces de common law. Ce serait un peu risqué de prendre cette interprétation-là, puisque l'affaire Van Breda parle aussi des contraintes constitutionnelles. Donc, c'est vraiment dans cet aspect-là de la décision qu'on peut avoir intérêt à s'y pencher de plus près pour voir si, d'une part, comme demandeur, on est à risque en choisissant de poursuivre au Québec, parce que peut-être les règles du Code civil ne sont pas suffisamment approprié pour se conformer à la limite constitutionnelle, ou si on est défendeur, pour trouver des nouveaux arguments pour éviter l'exercice de la compétence, l'établissement de la compétence du tribunal québécois. Alors, quelle que soit votre position, qui peut varier d'une affaire à l'autre, vous avez intérêt à vous demander ce que fait l'arrêt Van Breda au Québec. Alors, il n'y a pas de doute que l'affaire Van Breda a des effets au niveau de la déclaration des limites constitutionnelles sur la compétence des tribunaux. Comme l'a dit ma collègue, c'est vraiment la première décision où la Cour suprême dit de manière explicite que c'est à cause de la limite dans la Constitution à l'article 92, les mots « dans la province », que les tribunaux, les législateurs sont limités dans l'exercice de leurs compétences juridictionnelles au niveau international. Donc, ils ne peuvent pas entendre n'importe quoi. Ils ont des limites qui sont imposées par la Constitution elle-même. La question a toujours été, mais quelles sont ces limites-là? Comment est-ce qu'elles se traduisent dans une interprétation spécifique des différentes dispositions ou des différentes affaires? Je dirais que l'arrêt Van Breda par rapport au Québec, il y a des bons puis des mauvais côtés. Donc, ce que j'ai dit, il y a des bonnes nouvelles et il y a des mauvaises nouvelles. La première bonne nouvelle, c'est le fait que le juge Lebel, puis notez, le juge Lebel, c'est un juge du Québec, qui se prononce sur une affaire de common law, qui écrit au nom de la Cour sur une affaire de common law. Vous n'êtes peut-être pas surpris qu'il mette de l'avant une approche qui n'est pas contraire à l'approche méthodologique qu'on trouve dans le Code civil du Québec, c'est-à-dire préférer des règles qui sont plus prévisibles qu'une approche ad hoc qui caractérisait jusque-là l'approche des tribunaux en Ontario. Mais on peut aussi supposer qu'il sait qu'il y a des règles différentes dans le Code civil du Québec, même s'il ne les mentionne pas. Et si c'est, pour moi, j'essaie de lire entre les lignes, mais on voit qu'à trois reprises, il répète le fait que les contraintes constitutionnelles qu'il identifie n'imposent pas l'uniformité des règles au niveau national. En d'autres mots, c'est pas parce qu'il y a une contrainte constitutionnelle que nécessairement on doit avoir les mêmes règles partout. Puis il répète ensuite dans une autre partie du jugement en disant « des solutions différentes et des approches différentes sont possibles ». Et il ajoute même, et ça je ne l'ai pas indiqué, il se réfère spécifiquement au fait que les différents législateurs dans les différentes provinces peuvent faire les choses différemment. Alors c'est clair qu'il nous invite, comme juristes du Québec, à prendre pour acquis que la diversité des solutions, elle n'est pas a priori un obstacle. On ne peut pas s'objecter sur le simple fait qu'il y a des règles différentes dans le Code civil par rapport à ce qu'il a prévu, par exemple, en Ontario. De plus, il confirme ou réaffirme la validité constitutionnelle, on présume, des fondements de compétences traditionnelles dont la présence et le consentement, la présence qu'on peut voir, on peut voir le pendant avec la résidence et le domicile au Québec. Donc, à première vue, il y a plein de dispositions dans le titre 3 qui sont évidemment, je le dis peut-être de façon trop enthousiaste, évidemment constitutionnelles. Et là, c'est la compétence basée sur le domicile du défendeur. Tous les liens avec le défendeur sont, il me semble, sans objection. La compétence sur la personne morale avec son établissement et des activités au Québec, elle est très près du carrying on business, donc on ne peut pas voir de défaut là. La commission d'une faute dans la juridiction où le préjudice, et ça je vais y revenir, ça semble aussi être le tort committed in the province. On ne peut pas voir d'objection. Et finalement, en matière contractuelle. Et là, the bad news. Il faut toujours avoir l'autre côté de la médaille. La Cour suprême a rejeté de façon explicite certains des fondements juridictionnels qu'on retrouve dans le Code civil. Je vais essayer d'ajouter des bémols à ça, mais à première vue, la compétence basée sur la seule présence du défendeur, elle est au moins en matière de torts, elle est mise à l'écart, mais peut-être plus généralement. Aussi, les dommages ressentis ou subis ou occasionnés dans la province semblent avoir été mis à l'écart. Et finalement, sur la partie incidente, le recours incident, la Cour d'appel, elle, les avait plutôt mis à l'écart et la Cour suprême ne semble pas dire qu'ils ont eu tort. Alors, les règles qui, à mon avis, sont susceptibles de se voir contestées au niveau de leur validité constitutionnelle sont certainement l'article 31-48, paragraphe 3, en particulier dans une interprétation élargie. L'article 31-49, vous vous souvenez, donne aux consommateurs et aux employés québécois accès au tribunal québécois sur le seul fondement de leur propre résidence, et possiblement l'article 31-39. Pourquoi 31-48, paragraphe 3? Bien, la définition du mot « damage » en anglais, « préjudice » en français, elle est ouverte à interprétation. Dans les cas qui ont été mentionnés, qui ont donné lieu au litige Van Breda, vous aviez des accidents qui ont eu lieu à l'étranger, c'était des préjudices physiques, en fait, une personne préjudice physique, l'autre personne est décédée, et c'est ensuite quand la personne est revenue lourdement handicapée dans un cas, et l'autre c'est le recours de la veuve, ces personnes-là reviennent à leur domicile d'origine ou reviennent au Canada, et là, entreprennent le recours. Okay? Donc, il n'y a pas de doute qu'ils ont subi des pertes en Ontario ou ailleurs, mais la question, c'est est-ce qu'ils ont subi le préjudice? Qu'est-ce que c'est le préjudice? Est-ce que c'est limité au préjudice immédiat causé par la faute? Ou au contraire, est-ce que ça s'étend à toutes les conséquences de ce préjudice-là? Mais la Cour suprême, dans une affaire antécédente, l'affaire Spar Aerospace, avait donné une interprétation très large à la notion de préjudice sous l'article 31-48, paragraphe 3. Bon, je vous fais grâce des faits, mais il en ressortait qu'il y avait vraiment une invitation aux tribunaux à interpréter cette notion de préjudice de façon large, l'idée étant qu'avec la discrétion prévue par la doctrine du forum non-convenience, on pouvait contrôler par après les excès juridictionnels. Alors, dans Spar, c'était le juge Lebel qui avait écrit ces motifs-là, il nous invitait à vraiment lier ces deux éléments-là ensemble. Donc, on peut être généreux d'un côté parce qu'on a un correctif d'autre part. À la Cour d'appel du Québec, on a une jurisprudence un peu plus ambiguë. Du côté du préjudice corporel, les tribunaux au Québec ont pris une approche très généreuse. Je donne deux exemples encore des cas de gens qui vont en vacances et qui subissent des préjudices physiques, reviennent au Québec et là, soit doivent continuer à être hospitalisés ou souffrent des pertes de jouissance de la vie, etc., et veulent poursuivre au Québec. Et dans ces deux cas-là, donc l'Hôtel des Camerons et Nosser, la Cour d'appel du Québec dit « il n'y a pas de problème » à saisir les tribunaux du Québec, même si le seul lien avec le Québec, c'est le fait que le demandeur continue de subir les séquelles de son accident. Et ce, sans la présence des autres éléments qu'il y avait dans Van Breda et Charron, pas de contrat local, pas de présence du défendeur au Québec. Du côté contractuel ou du côté du préjudice économique, donc, on peut comprendre les tribunaux, ils voient des gens avec des préjudices physiques sérieux, leur dire, ben, retournez à l'endroit où vous avez subi ce préjudice pour poursuivre. On peut comprendre la sympathie du tribunal qui voudrait leur donner accès à leur tribunal local. Dans les cas de préjudice économique ou de contrat, peut-être que cet aspect de sympathie pour la victime n'est pas présent, et là, les tribunaux ont été plus restrictifs. Ont vraiment exigé la localisation du préjudice économique au Québec. Et deux exemples, une approche qui est très restrictive dans Québécois, Printing et Régionnaire, c'est deux affaires de la Cour d'appel, et récemment dans Options consommateurs et Infineon Technologies, justement une affaire de prix excessif payé pour un ordinateur au motif qu'une des composantes avait un prix excessif dû à un complot pour fixer les prix. Donc, vraiment le même type d'affaire que l'affaire des diamants contre De Beers en Colombie-Britannique. Et là, la Cour d'appel a dit, mais le préjudice économique comme tel, c'est un préjudice, mais pour le localiser au Québec, il faut vraiment qu'il y ait des faits matériels liés au Québec. C'est pas juste dire, on a une perte pécuniaire qui va être inscrite à nos livres au Québec parce qu'on est une compagnie québécoise. Je vois le temps qui file. Donc, vous voyez, d'une part, avec la jurisprudence actuelle à la Cour d'appel du Québec, il y a un gros risque de conflit entre ce que dit la Cour suprême dans l'affaire Van Breda et ce que dit la Cour d'appel dans les cas de préjudice physique. Parce qu'il semblerait que le préjudice physique, si c'est juste les conséquences du dommage initial en vertu de Van Breda, c'est insuffisant. La jurisprudence du Code civil, la Cour d'appel, dit quelque chose de différent. Mais ce n'est pas le Code civil lui-même qui le dit. Donc, on ne peut pas attaquer la disposition, mais on pourrait attaquer l'interprétation. Donc, invoquer Van Breda pour remettre en question cette jurisprudence de la Cour d'appel. En matière de contrat de consommation et contrat d'emploi, là encore, on peut penser que c'est insuffisant d'avoir juste ce lien avec le demandeur. Par contre, dans l'affaire Van Breda, le juge Lebel, il fait attention de dire « en l'absence d'autres considérations ». Mais il ne nous dit pas quelles sont ces considérations-là. Est-ce que la politique de protection de la partie vulnérable, l'idée étant qu'en matière de contrat d'emploi et de contrat de consommation, c'est des parties vulnérables au contrat, on voit la protection qui leur est accordée par des lois en matière d'emploi, là sur la protection du consommateur. Donc, c'est ça qui viendrait justifier un exercice plus généreux de la compétence des tribunaux du Québec. Donc, est-ce que c'est possible de sauver cette disposition-là en invoquant les considérations qui justifient l'étendue de la compétence, même si, en principe, la seule présence du demandeur serait insuffisante? Puis c'est là où je vous invite à vous rappeler de toutes ces règles basées sur la compétence, sur la présence du demandeur en matière familiale. Ça serait dur à imaginer que toutes ces règles-là enfreignent la limite constitutionnelle parce que le lien est avec le demandeur seulement. C'est sûr que la nature des questions en litige en matière de droit personnel, de droit familial, sont différentes, les considérations sont différentes de celles qui se présentent en matière de responsabilité civile. Et c'est la même chose pour... j'ai mis 49, mais c'est 39. Pardon. Ça, c'est la règle sur les recours incidents ou les recours... les counterclaims, donc une demande reconventionnelle. Non, c'est pas les incidents ou... Oui, je me souviens pas de l'expression exacte de 31-39. Mais donc, l'idée, c'est souvent les appels en garantie. Donc, le demandeur poursuit le défendeur qui appelle en garantie une autre partie. L'article 31-39 dit si le tribunal est compétent par rapport à la demande principale, il est aussi compétent. On peut comprendre pourquoi c'est beaucoup plus utile de régler tous ces problèmes-là dans la même instance. Pourtant, est-ce qu'il y a un lien réel et substantiel avec le défendeur en garantie? C'est là où la question peut se poser. Et encore là, il faut trouver des motifs qui sont un peu différents de ce qui est prévu dans l'affaire Van Breda pour justifier. Il faut faire appel aux questions d'efficacité, de justice entre les parties, d'éviter la multiplicité des procédures puis la possibilité de décisions contradictoires dans les différents forums. Donc, il y a des raisons d'administration de la justice, d'égalité, d'équité entre les parties, mais ce sont des motifs que, dans Van Breda, la Cour suprême semble avoir mis de côté, en disant que pour la compétence, c'est vraiment les liens factuels qui importent. Et ça, ce sont des considérations qui sont d'ordre de politique législative plus que des règles factuelles. Donc, je pense que il y a un risque au moins que ce soit contesté. Est-ce que ça va réussir? C'est une question différente. Alors, en conclusion, je pense que Van Breda est important, doit faire partie des décisions que les juristes au Québec doivent considérer et que ça remplace l'affaire Spar Aerospace qui, jusqu'à date, avait été l'arrêt privilégié en matière de compétences et de forum non-convenience. Que l'arrêt Spar qui avait dit que les règles du Code civil respectaient de manière implicite le critère du lien réel et substantiel, ça s'est mis de côté, je pense, par Van Breda. Puis remarquez, c'est toujours le juge Lebel. Alors, on peut dire qu'il savait ce qu'il faisait dans Van Breda. Il se souvenait, on l'espère, de ce qu'il avait dit auparavant dans l'affaire Spar Aerospace. Et ensuite, que le forum non-convenience, on ne peut plus l'utiliser comme correctif pour une interprétation large des dispositions sur la compétence. Il a dit ça précisément dans Van Breda. Ce sont des questions indépendantes, autonomes. Il faut les tenir séparées. Donc, encore une fois, ça permet plus de justifier l'approche généreuse qui avait été prise dans Spar Aerospace. Et donc, à mon avis, l'affaire Van Breda invite les juristes ou les professeurs à se poser des questions sur la validité constitutionnelle, soit des dispositions elles-mêmes ou de leur application à des cas d'espèce. Et donc, ça ouvre la porte à un nouvel argument pour contester la compétence. Est-ce que ça va réussir? Ça, c'est de la spéculation, mais il n'y a pas de doute que l'affaire Van Breda remet cette question-là, je pense, à l'avant-champ et suggère des possibilités de remise en question de ce qu'on a en ce moment dans le Code civil du Québec. Et voilà, j'ai fini. We're like machines.
We're machines.
Wow. I'd like to thank both our speakers for incredibly comprehensive, instructive, interesting, and thoughtful presentations. presentations. We're going to send you off on the break now. I think you all deserve it. Those were, wow, filled 40 minutes each and to the minute each. It was really amazing. So during the break, while you're getting a snack, while you're speaking to some colleagues, while you're relaxing for a moment, think about some of these presentations, because we're going to start right after the break with a Q&A with Professor Sommier and Walsh, and then we'll hear from Professor Bachand. So we'll be back in 15 minutes.
You find it?
Yeah, yeah.
How are you going to do that?
Just go in House Breeze Laws of Canada.
That is proof of foreign law?
It's my point about whether we really need experts in this day and age.
Well, do you think
contracts.
A judge in Texas can understand the doctrine of good faith under Article 31, 1375?
Badum. That's all it is.
Yep. 9 o'clock would be the outer limit.
Okay, that's good. Perfect.
I don't know that case.
That's the American case I'm going to be talking about.
Oh, okay. Oh, good.
Where they essentially said, no. None of that expert nonsense. French law was applicable.
Wow.
They say French law is readily available in English secondary sources. We don't need more. We can do this. Screw the experts.
That's ridiculous.
I don't think so.
Posner
and Easterbrook.
It's a very influential case.
Well, you'll see.
Okay.
That's the whole point of the proportionality.
Fun.
And
fun.
Okay, I need to grab something too.
Yeah, grab. I think this is Geneviève's. I hope I can read this. Personal actions of an extra patrimonial and family nature mean either one or the other, or does it have to include family issues?
Yes, 3141.
Okay, perfect.
And this one.
Got a lot of questions, I'm not guaranteeing both.
Okay, the important one.
And the wording of 3136.
This is the
interpreted
one because we're always talking about sufficient connection, and they talk about right here if the dispute has sufficient connection. She said it didn't apply, but.
Sorry.
Is there a case for example? I'm just asking a few specifications. I just spoke with Professor Walsh, who taught. Defamation would be a patrimonial nature. But Bourdain says otherwise.
Sorry, what's your question, 3136?
She said that it doesn't have direct application to Quebec. But they're talking all throughout the Van Breeden judgment
of
sufficient
connection.
And so here they talk about the sufficient connection in exactly those words. So I'm wondering if you can say that the interpretation of sufficient connection in the Sarah
Okay, perfect. Thanks. Oh, yeah. Yeah, start bringing them in.
absolutely. I've got a lot of questions, but I'll try to get to it. Cette session se termine à 9h. Oh, pardon, dans 5 minutes. Ouais, dans 5 minutes.
No, that's a new one for Fred. 10 minutes.
Okay. Could you please take your seats? We've got to get going. Got a whole list. Welcome back. You heeded my advice. I have received a wonderful number of questions, so obviously the two presentations really gave you a lot to think about. Before we turn to your questions, and I apologize, we're not going to be able to get to them all. As I said, many of you have asked very interesting questions. I would like to give Professor Walsh an opportunity to briefly clarify the situation of family-type cases after Van Breda.
Thank you, Rosalie. I just wanted to confirm that the presentation was restricted to what the civil code would call matters of a patrimonial nature. There have been cases post Van Breda in the family law area where the particular statute did not explicitly provide a jurisdictional rule, and the courts interpreted Van Breda as applicable, but concluded with it when it comes to a real and substantial connection where it's a family relationship, then any member of the family, regardless of who is the person who initiated the proceeding, constitutes, if they reside in province, a sufficient connection. So they didn't see the reference to the plaintiff's presence as being insufficient as applicable outside areas pertaining to the law of obligations.
Great, thank you. We have questions that are sometimes very particular, questions that are plus large. I'm just going to go through some of the questions that the audience has given. Si on utilise Van Breda pour contester juridiction autrement établie par un article de Code civil du Québec, est-ce qu'on doit demander que l'article soit déclaré non constitutionnel?
Je pense qu'il y a des différentes façons d'aborder la constitutionnalité. On peut, d'une part, inviter le tribunal au Québec à interpréter une disposition de manière à se conformer à la Constitution. Donc, je pense que l'article 3148, paragraphe 3, par exemple, dans l'interprétation de ce qui constitue un préjudice subi au Québec, ce serait possible, sans déclarer l'article comme étant inconstitutionnel, de déclarer qu'il doit s'interpréter en fonction des liens réels et substantiels. Ce qui aurait pour effet, à mon avis, de changer le résultat dans les deux affaires de la Cour d'appel je vous ai mentionnées. D'autre part, peut-être qu'il y aura un argument selon lequel l'article 3149, qui octroie la compétence au tribunal québécois sur la seule base de la de résidence du consommateur, même si le consommateur est allé en Floride puis s'est acheté un iPod, là, le ramène au Québec, puis il ne fonctionne pas. L'article 3149 dit qu'il peut procéder devant les tribunaux du Québec, même s'il n'y a aucun lien avec la transaction. Ça, je pense que cet article-là est peut-être plus fragile. On pourrait contester au motif qu'il n'y a pas la présence du lien réel et substantiel suffisant dans l'article à sa face même. Mais je pense que c'est peut-être plus sage de toujours chercher à inviter une interprétation qui est conforme à la Constitution plutôt, parce que si vous voulez attaquer la constitutionnalité, là, il faut faire venir le procureur général, là, ça devient une affaire très compliquée. Mais de simplement inviter le tribunal à l'interpréter, la disposition, de façon à être conforme à ce que dit Van Breda, je pense que c'est au moins une façon de reconnaître son effet au Québec.
Here's a question. In the following example, could a Quebec court accept jurisdiction? By a forum selection clause, the parties designate State X as the jurisdiction. But under the laws of State X, the clause would be invalid. Hence, X refuses to hear the case. How would Quebec react? Or any other province?
It's always a problem to ask the question, according to whose law should you be assessing the validity of a contractual agreement? The same could be said for choice of law clauses, for example. And technically, the code says that if the provision designates another state, the Quebec courts don't have jurisdiction. The only thing that the party is trying to avoid can, that clause is to claim that it's invalid. And usually invalidity will relate to consent to the clause or to other aspects related to the existence of the agreement. But it would be unusual for the reason for the invalidity to be that it would not be upheld by the jurisdiction that has been designated. In other parts of the code, there's reference to the fact that where the choice of the parties invalidates their agreement, well, we'll disregard that choice. And I think that the similar argument could be made here. We'll disregard the forum selection clause if the forum selection clause is incapable of being performed, same way as it happens in arbitration. I don't think I've ever seen a case, though, that has raised that fact situation in Quebec.
Okay. Another question. Has internet commerce expanded the place a defendant does business to everywhere the internet is available?
No. No. But it has expanded the possibilities. For example, I referred to the fact that publication within the forum is sufficient to localize a tort and defamation actions. There's a recent Alberta case where publication on a Facebook page, by virtue of the fact that the particular person had five friends in Alberta, and it was automatically posted on their wall, it could be presumed that it had been read in Alberta, therefore publication had occurred, therefore the Alberta courts had jurisdiction. In other contexts, the post-Van Breda jurisprudence is reassuring. There's a recent Ontario case, of course everything post-Van Breda is recent, in which somebody booked a hotel room on an internet site in London. They were injured while they were staying at the hotel in London, and the court concluded that simply making available in Ontario an internet access point for booking hotels abroad did not constitute carrying on business. So I think we can hope for common sense to prevail.
We didn't talk that much about class actions, but what is the impact of the Van Breda decision on class actions, and to what extent does there have to be a presumptive connecting factor with maybe more than just the representative plaintiff, with all the class members? That's probably a very loaded big question.
Huh. Is it necessary for the representative plaintiff to show that every plaintiff in the class has their own, has satisfied the presumptive connecting factor in the wake of Van Breda? The same would presumably arise in Quebec to the extent of the constitutional dimension. And that is a similar question to the question that was raised with respect to, say, necessary or proper party. Where in some instances the idea of avoiding multiplicity of proceedings is enough to avoid the need for a independent presumptive connection. In the past class proceeding, as you know, the idea of not splitting the proceeding and so forth has gotten us over that problem. Whether it's going to reemerge, it may very well, with the constitutional dimension, post-Van Breda is indeed a question that, not being a judge, I don't answer.
Yeah. The only thing I would add to that is that question of the links of the class members to the jurisdiction was asked in a previous case, in the Canada Post and Lépine case, and the decision written by Lebel for the court avoided answering that question completely. So I'm not surprised that, I mean, it didn't come up at all in Van Breda, but I don't know that even if he were pushed on the effect of Van Breda on that question, that he would be prepared to answer. It's a vexing question, and there's no, I think, easy solution to it.
If the proceeding is opt-in, you've got consent of the defendants as a sufficient connection, and Van Breda confirms consent remains without any need for additional presumptive connection. But opt-out is more common, and that's where it arises.
Here's a specific question about Article 3136, which says, even though a Quebec authority has no jurisdiction to hear a dispute, it may hear it if the dispute has a sufficient connection with Quebec. The precise question is, the very reference to sufficient connection in Article 3136, does that necessarily require the application of Van Breda to arguments under this article? So does that, the wording of the very codal article, bring in the Van Breda decision?
That's an interesting point. So the Article 3136, which is the jurisdiction, the form of necessity, interestingly, in the civil code, you have that added condition. There has to be some link to Quebec, whereas the equivalent in the CJPTA doesn't have the requirement of a connection. So here it's a case where the common law province's statute is actually broader and I think more at risk of a challenge under Van Breda than the Quebec provision. So yes, in a way, it makes explicit that there has to be some connection, but it doesn't say, you know, what the connection is. And in most cases of form of necessity, the connection is usually going to be with the plaintiff. So the plaintiff is here. Why? Because it's the only place that they can sue. So it just raises, again, the problem, is a connection with the plaintiff sufficient to meet constitutional scrutiny? So I don't think that the presence of those words actually guarantees the constitutional validity of the provision or of its application in any case.
I would just add that form of necessity is also recognized as a jurisdictional base, even in provinces that haven't enacted the CJVTA, but this particular question has not received much attention. And as I think I mentioned in my presentation, Justice LaBelle avoided three times that form of necessity issue, so clearly did not want to get into it or see it as part of the exercise. So we can assume that it's open, that some different form of analysis might result.
And what impact has the Van Breda decision had on the determination of applicable law in multi-jurisdictional torts? Because thus far we've just been talking about jurisdiction of the court.
Well, I mentioned that there were two companion decisions in defamation that were decided at the same time as Van Breda. And the main point of those decisions was to confirm that a publication localized the tort and therefore satisfied the second factor in the Van Breda presumptive list of connections for tort. But in those decisions, the court also, and it was Justice LaBelle, ventured into the issue of choice of law for defamation and suggested that the traditional common law rule, which applies to law of the place of the tort, might not be the rule for defamation. Instead, it would be the jurisdiction in which the most substantial injury to reputation occurred. So an Ontario court could take jurisdiction on the basis that there was publication there, but at the choice of law level, one might end up applying, let's say, the more restrictive law of defamation in the United States if it could be shown that the victim's reputation suffered its most substantial harm in that jurisdiction. And the idea of this alternative choice of law rule, he suggested, was aimed at discouraging forum shopping. Because if publication vests jurisdiction everywhere, then that's an invitation to look for the most sympathetic defamation law from the plaintiff's perspective. But if they don't get that law on account of the choice of law rule being not the place of publication, but rather the place of most substantial harm, then it will deter that from happening. European Union is considering something similar for the same reasons in this area. So, yes, I think place of the tort, what this implies, is that the place of the tort may be decided differently at the jurisdictional level than at the choice of law level. And that possibility was already there in products liability cases, and I think that's simply been brought out more clearly. So from common law side, it's certainly opened the door to a new analysis of whether Tollefson's place of the tort rule is that universal or whether we're going to start crafting specific choice of law rules for certain areas.
Well, I'd like to thank both our speakers. I'm going to leave them with one more question. It's a little bit of an unfair question, and maybe we'll leave it as a rhetorical one. I will admit right now it's my question. My question is, what if in Van Breda the forum competing with Ontario was Texas instead of Cuba? Would we have the same outcome? Maybe I won't have them comment on that publicly. And now I'd like to call upon Veronique to introduce our final speaker. Thank you so much, both of you.
Monsieur Bachand va s'adresser à vous en anglais, mais je vais le présenter en français à mon tour maintenant et de vous dire, en fait, et de remercier nos trois speakers de ce soir, nos conférenciers de ce soir, parce que c'est, comme plusieurs d'entre vous le savez, la deuxième fois, tous les trois, en fait, qui participent à cette série de conférences. Et donc, en votre nom et au nom de ma collègue Rosalie, je veux les remercier de revenir nous voir ce soir. Alors... Alors, Frédéric Bachand est professeur agrégé à la faculté où il enseigne dans les domaines de l'interprétation juridique, des modes extrajudiciaires de résolution différents, du droit des investissements internationaux, du droit judiciaire privé et de la preuve civile. Il est membre actif de l'équipe de recherche Justice privée et État de droit de McGill. Il est également co-directeur du programme d'été en arbitrage de McGill et rédacteur en chef d'un site web bilingue sur l'arbitrage conventionnel au Québec, qu'il a fondé en 2004. Il détient des doctorats de l'Université Panthéon à Assas et de l'Université de Montréal. Il a été clerc auprès du juge Gérard Laforêt à la Cour suprême du Canada. Il est membre de nombreux organismes professionnels et il est actuellement correspondant national auprès de la Commission des Nations unies pour le droit commercial international. Monsieur Bachand, enfin, agit à titre de consultant et expert, tant sur la scène locale qu'à l'échelle internationale, et il a agi à titre d'expert en droit canadien et québécois dans le cadre d'instances judiciaires et arbitrales étrangères. Je vous demande donc d'accueillir le professeur Bachand.
Merci. Merci beaucoup, Véronique. Merci, Rosalie. Quoi? T'as-tu main? OK. Je vais juste mettre la présentation ici. Ça me fait très plaisir. Je suis un peu mal à l'aise parce que mes diapos sont vraiment pas aussi belles que celles de mes collègues. I'm really embarrassed. I'm going to steal their templates and get at least a title slide for next time. I'm delighted to be back here and see so many friendly faces and former students. You know what that means? I may call on you during the next half hour or so, but I'm delighted to see you here. I'm not going to talk directly about Van Breda. My topic is the proof of foreign law. It may sound very technical and not a great topic for such a late talk, but you'll see that what I want to do is try to connect some of the procedural questions that arise in these, let's call them international cases, to broader issues of access to justice. And we'll use the law or procedures relating to the proof of foreign law to think a little bit about broader questions of access to justice. Because when I was reading Van Breda and when I was listening to your presentations, I kept thinking, this is so complicated. I mean, the approach, especially after Van Breda, the approach to determining international jurisdiction from a common law perspective, as you could see, is not very easy to figure out. And I kept wondering, what about the impacts in practice on costs and the complexity of these preliminary motions, which ask, when you think about it, a very basic question. Can we sue here? Yes or no? We are far from even starting to deal with the merits. And you can see with the discretion, the multi-layered discretion that exists now, how litigating, debating these preliminary questions can actually be very costly and time-consuming in practice. So keep that in mind. We'll come back to that issue in a second. So why care about foreign law, and why care about how foreign law is proved? I'll get to that in a few minutes. I want to start with a few basic preliminary points so that we're all on the same page. This is true. These are just global, I mean, propositions which are true in every modern legal systems today. Every legal system today will provide for the occasional application of foreign law. Now, mind you, this is only true in private law matters, in civil and commercial cases. You never see a judge hearing a criminal trial applying foreign law or dealing with an administrative dispute. But this is true. We consider that it's appropriate and worthwhile in some cases to require that our judges apply foreign law. And the rules will do this for a host of reasons. Sometimes it has to do with meeting or protecting the party's legitimate expectations. So there are a host of rules which essentially render applicable the law of a foreign state to which the dispute is most closely connected. So you have this idea of finding out the closest connection and identifying the law which will be applicable, and it sounds very technical, but the basic reason why we do this is because the parties will have legitimate expectations that the law of France or Belgium will be applicable in a given case. Personal autonomy, which we've heard about since Eric and Lola, which the Supreme Court reminded us how fundamental a principle that is, will underlie rules that many of you are familiar with that essentially uphold, render fully effective choice of law clause. So when the parties can get together and say, we want our dispute to be resolved in accordance with Belgian law, the law will give effect to this choice. Some rules that call for the application of foreign law will be based on principles of comity and sovereignty. In some circumstances, we will apply foreign rules of public order, public policy, the so-called loi de police, because we consider it's a valid reason to respect a policy choice which is made by a foreign state. We'll look at the connections with that state, but that will not be the determinative factors. And then sometimes we're looking at more substantive principles, such as the protection of the child's interest, which underlies some rules in matters such as filiation that will occasionally call for the application of foreign law, or the protection of vulnerable parties like consumers, insured, or employees in an employment law context. Second basic proposition accepted everywhere: judges don't know or can't be assumed to know the contents of foreign law, which is very different than how we approach local law. Of course, no judge knows all Quebec law, but we presume that, they are deemed to know local law. And what this means practically is that we understand and expect judges to be able to readily ascertain the contents of local law through sources which are in the community recognized as being very authoritative. We can't assume that or make the same assumption with respect to foreign law. And all legal systems recognize that. So this is why all legal systems have rules and regulate the process through which judges, when those rules are applicable, will ascertain the contents of foreign law. Okay, so that said, back to my initial question, why should we care about this tonight? Well, there's one simple point. It has to do with globalization. Globalization means more international legal relationships. It means more international disputes. It increases the number of cases where our judges are confronted with or called upon to apply foreign law. And this is not only in commercial matters. You may have commercial cases in mind, but we're seeing an increase in cases in consumer matters, in employment matters. Family law is a huge part of these international disputes where foreign law is potentially applicable to a case. Now, the second point has to do with something that's very depressing, but you're probably aware of it, the crisis that is faced by our system of civil justice. And it's not exaggerated to speak of a crisis. When Section 96 Superior Court judges in Canada go on the record publicly in conferences to say or to suggest that they couldn't afford their own system if they were tied up in a civil and commercial disputes, we have a huge problem. I mean, these are people who are well within the 1%. You may have seen the stats last night. The cutoff officially is at $2,001 this year in Canada to be part of the 1%. Our judges are well within that. Even our Cour du Québec judges, thanks to the increases that have occurred in the past few years. And here's a useful piece of cocktail trivia for you. Cour du Québec judges now make more than associate justices of the U.S. Supreme Court. Not kidding. Which is good. I mean, socially, we like that. We want judges to be well paid, but they're well off. But it's very troubling when you have people who are at the heart of the system who go publicly on the record saying, I couldn't afford my own system. We need to be concerned with that. We want our civil justice system to be responsive to globalization, to respond effectively to these increasingly frequent international cases or civil and commercial disputes which have an international dimension. So back to our topic, we don't want to have rules regarding the proof of foreign law which hinder access to justice or which jeopardize these important policies which underlie rules which sometimes call upon for the application of foreign law. Okay, let's talk about, I'll call it the typical common law approach. I'm going to hesitate, is it the traditional common law approach or typical common law approach, but it's still widely in use. And I'm using the common law approach because in Quebec we've pretty much always, well, caveat, you'll see why. But traditionally, we followed a common law approach to issues of proof of foreign law. So how is foreign law typically proved in a common law system? Well, first proposition, foreign law has to be pleaded, which is kind of interesting because it means that the application of foreign law depends on the initiative of at least one party. Judges traditionally will not apply foreign law on their own motion, or sua sponte, or proprio motu. I was trying to find a third Latin phrase. I think there is one, but couldn't. It needs to be triggered by the initiative of one of the parties. Foreign law must be proved, which is logical given what we've said. Judges can't be assumed to know the contents of foreign law, so there must be a formal process whereby they ascertain the content of these rules. Foreign law must be proved, but must be proved by the testimony of party-appointed experts. Proposition which is restated 2 years ago in a very authoritative part of Aylesbury's Laws of Canada. So this means that the typical approach is multi-step. First of all, the expert on foreign law needs to file a written report pre-trial. The other expert on the other side will file a written report. There may be written reports in response. And then much later, several months after, if not several years, they come back. And they're examined in chief, where they essentially repeat what's in the report. And then they're cross-examined. So like any other experts, their participation in the process will follow the normal steps taken by experts. So the same approach, as I mentioned, was typically adopted in Quebec. As you can already see, it's a lengthy, cumbersome, I insist on this, one-size-fits-all approach. Why do I mean by that? Because typically, the approach will be the same in a case where the law of Egypt needs to be proved and in a case where the law of Ontario needs to be proved. No distinction was typically made given the language barriers and different or similarities in legal cultures. There's an additional problem. Practitioners here will be probably familiar with that, a risk, and people disagree as to the extent to which the risk materializes in practice. There are two schools of thoughts on this. But the added problem of the partisan spin to the expert's opinion, because bear in mind, we're talking about experts not appointed by the court, not court-appointed expert, but by we're talking about party-appointed experts. So that's the typical common law approach, and I want to explain to you why I have problems with it, and I'll develop two points or highlight two problems, and then we'll consider what can be done in Quebec with the tools available to judges to address these problems. First of all, problems of proportionality, and second, problems of coherence that I want to draw your attention to. Now, proportionality, you're probably aware of the rise, we could call it the rise of proportionality, which has been sort of a centerpiece of reforms of the civil justice system, not only in Quebec, but in many jurisdictions, I would say over the past 15 or 20 years. We tend to say that Lord Wolfe started the sort of proportionality movement at the end of the 1990s when he issued his report that served as the basis of the new English rules on civil procedure. And you can, when we think of proportionality, we can essentially think of a retreat from a one-size-fits-all approach. The idea is that we should try to adapt the procedure so that it corresponds to what is at stake and to the costs or the value in dispute. So let's test that. Let's test this traditional model with this ideal of proportionality. Now, there are four questionable I choose my words carefully. I'm not saying they're wrong. So they're questionable premises which underlie the traditional approach. And let's see, let's test them and think about whether we're convinced. Now, I'm not sure I'm going to convince everyone that this one is problematic, but it rests on one idea, which is sort of the starting point of everything, which is that getting it right on points of foreign law is really, really important. We devote a lot of energy to it. We allow experts to be involved in a full-fledged manner in the process. Why? Because our tolerance to mistakes is rather low. We want, ideally, our judges to rule accurately on points of foreign law. But is that so? Is that right? Does that make sense to you? Surely, when judges interpret local law, we want them to get it right. That's really important. Even when they're resolving purely private disputes. Why? Because like cases need to be treated alike. And even when a judge is resolving a divorce case, so resolving a dispute which only raises issues of private law, that judge may be called upon to make an interpretation of local law which may affect you, which may affect society at large after, because like cases ought to be treated alike. So there's a compelling interest for ensuring that judges will get it right when they apply local law. But these interests are not there. They're very different when judges have, when a Quebec judge, for instance, has to apply and interpret a rule of, you know, Egyptian law or Moroccan law. Of course, we want them to get them right, but is our sort of tolerance to mistakes the same? Should it be the same than when judges are resolving disputed questions of law? Question, think about it. Second questionable premise, experts, the involvement of experts is always necessary. What is the test to determine the admissibility of expert opinion in Canada? Yes, sir. Going. Okay, you're saying usefulness is, if the expert's involvement will be useful, then expert opinion should be admissible. Yeah. Who agrees with that? Who disagrees? Is helpfulness the test under Canadian law? It's related to that, but the test is actually necessity. The applicable standard in, you know, a broken leg case and you're determining whether a doctor should be, a physician should be involved, or a surgeon, orthopedist should be involved, is necessity. Is the expert's involvement necessary? So the approach, the typical common law approach, rests on this idea that the involvement of expert is always necessary, not merely useful or helpful, but necessary for judges to draw sufficiently accurate conclusions on points of foreign law. Now, is that right? I know Rosalie and I may disagree on this, but okay, let's do a little experiment. This is quick law. I will ascertain the content of Ontario contracts law. Contracts, here it is. What's our topic, our problem? Assignment is here. General considerations, that's our problem. There, we got it. a very authoritative, up-to-date statement of common law of contracts in Canada. Why is that not enough? We'll expand a little bit. That plus lawyers' input, case law research you can do going on Canly, which is a publicly accessible database. You're the judge. You have this. You do your own little research on Canly. You have Julien Morissette there who's pleading the case and Keith Flavelle on the other side, and they're part of the conversation. Do we need, is an expert on Ontario law necessary here? I don't know. I'm not sure. But think about that. Third point, third premise, a single court-appointed expert won't do. The typical practice is for parties to have their own experts. But even assuming that we've passed the necessity threshold, because there's a language barrier or it's a different legal tradition, whatever, why should we bother with party-appointed experts? Why isn't a court-appointed expert sufficient? You'll say, well, maybe, you know, party-appointed experts can have this conversation and we can hope to get it even more accurate on points of foreign law. And I'm like, well, again, go back to the first question. How accurate do we need to be or do we want to be? And bear in mind that judges are experts at legal reasoning. The judge is not as much in the dark as when, you know, an orthopedist is actually bringing to his or her attention specialized knowledge. We're talking about legal sources which are interpreted, all right, somewhat differently from one jurisdiction to the other, from one legal tradition to the other, but not significantly differently. So even that one, I think, is questionable. Sir? Sorry, what's the last part of your... Yes. Yeah, I'll get back to that and what the law now provides. I'm describing the typical approach and identifying areas of challenge or problems. Fourth point. Assuming that experts have a role to play here, and irrespective of whether we have in mind a single expert or party-appointed experts, another underlying premise of the typical approach is that a written report won't do. It's necessary for the expert to come back, repeat everything in court and examination in chief, and be cross-examined. Is that really necessary? Even if you accept that an expert should be involved, isn't it enough to have a report? And of course, then, you know, le contradictoire, which is done by the parties, the lawyers' arguments, won't you have enough as a judge to come to reasonably accurate conclusions to satisfy a threshold that should be the starting point of our analysis? Let me tell you a little bit about a really interesting American decision that was issued in 2010. Seventh Circuit Court. It's a federal appellate court, very influential appellate court in the U.S. And there was a dissent, but I just want to highlight the two judges in the majority were two of the most influential circuit judges in the U.S. right now, Richard Posner and Chief Judge Easterbrook. They're widely read, widely influential, very, very good, thoughtful judges. Very simply, international commercial dispute arising out of a contract involving an American entity and a European entity. French law was applicable through a choice of law clause in the contract. There was also an arbitration clause, but for some reason the party sort of ignored that, which was weird. So the merits of the case is before federal courts in the U.S., and that is the and there's a choice of law clause. There's a problem of contractual interpretation. There's a clause which is arguably ambiguous, and one party wants to rely on French rules of contract interpretation, which make it easier for the judge to go outside the four corners of the contract and bringing extrinsic evidence as to what the parties had in mind, and so on and so forth. And so both parties filed written expert reports from very well-known Sorbonne professors and well-known French lawyers who must have charged a fortune for very, very lengthy detailed reports exposing French law as it would be applicable or relevant in that case. And the majority's decision is what I find a very, very compelling plea for abandoning the traditional approach. Here's some great, the starting point of their analysis is to say, look, French law is readily available in English. They're like, look, Chief Judge Easterbrook and Judge Posner are just, you know, typing in databases that are accessible to them, and then they pull out tons of law journal articles written by American scholars, comparative scholars, in English for a foreign audience, explaining the rules of contract interpretation from a French perspective, very recent authoritative studies and so on. They're saying, look, I mean, we have it. We have very reliable secondary sources, and France, like most, I'm not sure they're right on this, but they say the law of France, like the law of most jurisdictions involved in international commerce, is readily available in English. For law of France, for French contract law, that may make sense. I'm thinking we're going a bit too far in extending that proposition to other jurisdictions. Look at what they think of expert opinion in general, and specifically expert opinion on points of foreign law. You know, of course they're hired. They're hired because they will be writing exactly what the parties are supporting. So the judges are saying, we know that this is going to be partisan in any event, so that's not going to be helpful. We'll have to discount the value of their opinion because of that, of the inherent partisan spin. So in many cases, secondary sources will not only suffice, they may even be preferable to written expert reports. So they say, none of that. We need to end this practice right away. I mean, information technology matters also to this analysis. It's much easier now than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago for judges to access legal sources, foreign legal sources, through authoritative databases. And the dissenting judge was like a bit of uncomfortable with that, saying, yeah, we need to be sort of modern and think about this, but there's no need to disparage oral testimony from experts in the foreign law. That kind of testimony has been used by responsible lawyers for years, and there will be many instances in which it is adequate by itself or provide a helpful gloss on the literature. I will let you decide, based on your own experience, whether the presumption should be that expert opinion reports on points of foreign law, or generally the presumption should be that they're accurate and objective, or whether it should be reversed. This is a very controversial question. All right, so the second problem I want to draw your attention to is what I call a problem of coherence. So let's compare the traditional approach to proving foreign law to how judges handle foreign law, but in a very different context. Not because foreign law is applicable to the merits of the case, but because foreign law is useful to figuring out the contents of local rules. Judges do this all the time now. They interpret the charter, very open-ended, open-textured provision, by relying on European law or American law. They will use foreign law as comparative law. They do this with constitutional provisions. They do this with statutory provisions. They do this with codal provisions. You see elements of, you know, French law, Belgian law sometimes, Swiss law, supporting interpretations of our civil code or code of civil procedure. On one of the slides in the earlier presentations, the Supreme Court in Van Breda was saying, when we consider whether to adopt new presumptions, one of the factors we should take into consideration is the state of the law in other nations which share our commitment to order and fairness and so on. An explicit recognition of the sort of normative impact of comparative law, foreign law, in developing Canadian law. How is that done? How would we describe the practice of using foreign law in this very different context? It's completely different. First of all, to my knowledge, experts are rarely, if ever at all, involved in helping judges ascertain the content of foreign law to correctly interpret the charter or provision of the code. judges carry out comparative law research independently all the time. Well, maybe not first instance judges, they don't have the resources, but that's the Supreme Court level. Anybody who's done a clerkship knows that very often the court will go way beyond the authority submitted to the parties, embark in lengthy comparative analysis, and present that as being very important basis of the interpretations they arrive at the end. Most judges don't even feel, and this is a bit troubling to me, and it touches on another issue, but most judges don't even feel that they have to go back to the parties to offer them an opportunity to comment on the results of lengthy comparative law analysis that they've embarked on. So why do I say this is this seems incoherent? Because the interests in getting it right on foreign law, when it is used to justify interpretations of local law, is arguably much stronger. Hey, when the Supreme Court is relying on foreign law to interpret the Charter, a constitutional provision, which will trace the limits of the legislature's legislative powers, that's important. It's important to society as a whole. We want to make sure that they get it right on European human rights law before they, resort or rely on these foreign law propositions when interpreting the Charter. Help me out. I see an incoherence, so I can't explain it. If we're comfortable with what judges are doing here, freely ascertaining the contents of foreign law in this context, why are we so troubled? And why do we feel the need to constrain the process so much when foreign law is applicable to the merits of the dispute? Hey, there is some good news. Not all bad news. The good news is that I think judges have all the tools they need. We don't need a legislative, lengthy, cumbersome reform to actually fix these problems. And we've given judges these tools since 1994. And the key provision here is 2809, which essentially, I'm not going to read it, but you have it there, essentially, on my reading of things, give judges complete control over the process of proving foreign law. I think judges have enough here, and tie that to 4.2 proportionality in the Code of Civil Procedure. They have all they need to say, you two, I don't want to hear it. I don't want parties, experts to be involved. We'll use secondary sources. This is a $50,000 case. It makes no sense to have experts involved. And they have complete freedom. They can take judicial notice of foreign law, which essentially means doing research independently without getting experts involved and so on. They can require that proof be made. This doesn't mandate that they do this through party-appointed experts if they feel that experts are needed. I think a judge has enough power from this to say, agree on a single expert, otherwise I will appoint the expert and that'll be it. So the tools are there. I think what's needed is a change in practice. I think that 2809's potential remains untapped. I think there's a lot that can be done to ensure through a modern, effective use of 2809 that the system will be much more responsive to these increasingly frequent international cases that call for the application of foreign law. This is work in progress with, we're within four walls and en famille, as we say. This is the McGill family, so I'm just sharing with you ideas which are progressing. But this is how I see things now. I think we should completely flip the practice around. I think that what we call the traditional model or practice should become the option of last resort. It should be the when all else has failed option. This is the nuclear option of proving foreign law. I'm sort of convinced by Bodum, by the analysis of the American judges saying, look, start by considering whether sufficiently good, accurate, and up-to-date secondary sources are readily available. This may end the analysis. You may have enough there to reach reasonably accurate conclusions on points of foreign law. We should apply the necessity standard strictly, I think, when we consider whether experts should be involved. I think that the norm, the general practice should be we'll have a single expert, not party-appointed experts. I think there should be a presumption in favor of a single court-appointed expert. And again, I see little value in most cases in having the experts come testify and be examined at trial and be cross-examined. I think in many, many cases, if not most, this can be done on paper. And their opinions can be effectively challenged in writing by supplemental questions or by exchanges between the lawyers. I end with, a few minutes, just 2 minutes.
Wrap up.
I don't have a conclusion. I just have one more point. This is a word on interprovincial disputes. Hey, where's my question mark? There was a question mark here. Imagine that you're a Quebec judge. You need to apply Ontario law. There was a recent case I came across. Experts were involved, and again, I'm like, why? But who's best placed to provide advice on a difficult, disputed point of Ontario law? Ontario judge. Thank you. Bonus for you. My point is, what about judicial cooperation in all of this, especially in interprovincial disputes? Why don't we have a simple system whereby a Quebec judge can, through a simple procedure, ask a question to an Alberta judge and say, hey, I have this question that came up. Can you please answer this for me? And I'll do the same thing if, you know, a question arises in one of your cases. We have this kind of judicial cooperation to ensure circulation of judgments from one province to the other. You may be aware of this. Why don't we have this in Canada? I think, you could build a case based on the principle of federalism and full faith and credit and all these things and say it's a no-brainer. We should have something like that, especially that it exists elsewhere. We would have liked to be pioneers on that. But at the European level, there is a convention which, unfortunately, is not being used in practice. There are various reasons for that, but it's been around since the end of the 1960s. There that provides or allows for judicial cooperation. And very interestingly, if you want to have a look at that, the New South Wales Supreme Court in Australia, they have a very dynamic Chief Justice, I think, and he's been signing bilateral cooperation agreements with judges from other jurisdictions. One, I think the Southern District of New York has signed an agreement. Singapore courts have signed an agreement to start establishing this kind of practice. And we need this, don't we? Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a very thought-provoking, intriguing presentation. I haven't been near a courtroom in years and years and years, but you have me all gung-ho. We have time for a few questions. Given that we don't have much time, I'm happy to take questions by raised hand, or if people in the other rooms have questions they want to bring in, we can do that as well. Are there any questions here? Yes, sir.
So the question is, what happens in appeal when a conclusion on a point of foreign law is brought into appeal? The traditional approach in English law is no deference, if I recall correctly, is to say, and that's one place where the fiction that foreign law is treated as a fact doesn't hold, because appellate courts, if I recall correctly, were not limited in their review. Now, the Supreme Court, I'm not going to say whether they're right, and you're right in saying that they are experts in the laws of all jurisdictions and all the words. This is a good point, the issue of appeals, actually, when I was listening to Catherine and Geneviève, I looked back at Van Breda, Because I started wondering when this whole thing started. I mean, the Supreme Court of Canada decisions were rendered in 2012, last year. The accidents took place in 2003. The decisions at first instance before the Superior Court of Justice of Ontario, both in 2008. It took 10 years from the accident to the Supreme Court just to figure out where can they sue. This is pathetic when you think about it. Well, it is, and I think in Ontario law there are appeals as of right on these preliminary motions, if I recall correctly. There's no filter, there's no leave to appeal, and so on. So you're right to bring up the questions of appeal, because in a sort of our broader analysis of how these technical questions relate to broader questions of access to justice, that matters. And if you agree with me that we shouldn't care that much, you know, whether judges get it really, really perfectly right on points of foreign law, then we have an argument to limit appellate review of conclusions drawn, as you know, on the point of Egyptian law or Moroccan law, I think. Attack from the right. You chose to sit there. Okay. Ah, that's a good point. So limited, okay, so is the appeal, so, but the scenario is foreign law applicable to the merits, right? Not foreign law used as comparative law. I think we were talking about, I would assume those would be the normal rules in appeal. You stick to what's in the record. But if, really? Yeah? If it goes up to the Supreme Court and... Wow. Okay. Oh, yeah, but that makes sense. Yeah. In an interprovincial dispute, absolutely. Because the Supreme Court is an expert in all of the laws of Canada, but not if the law of Egypt is applicable to the substance or the merits. Geneviève.
I just want to try and link this back to Van Breda. In Van Breda, Justice Lebel, in listing the criteria for forum nonconvenience, includes a traditional one, which is the law applicable to the dispute.
Yeah.
From what you're saying, it seems to me that criterion should have a stronger impact. In other words, if I were pleading it, I would say pleading foreign law is such an obstacle, such a costly obstacle, please send us to the jurisdiction of the applicable law. Is that not an easier solution than revising the whole rules about?
But this is what is being
law.
This is what is being done right now. I mean, this is how they're making these arguments in foreign convenience analysis, like. Mr. Juge, look at how complicated it will be to prove foreign law and so on. And I don't think we want that, because if the complexity of the rules of foreign law restrict access to justice here, we have a problem. It doesn't make any sense, I think.
So thank you to Professor Bachand and to our two other speakers. Good night, and we'll see you on February 19th for a very interesting presentation on copyright and IP law generally in Canada.